This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a voice for the people program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on these websites and www.affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Professor Felicia Kornbluh. She's a professor at the University of Vermont, but what's very interesting is she's written a new book called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. Welcome to Wade's World, Professor Kornbluh.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime we can get people to talk about welfare, welfare reform, or this whole bloody mess we have in the welfare system, it's a pleasure. Now, you have spent decades really looking at welfare and the ravages it's wrought, haven't you?
I have. Yeah, before I was a college professor, I was an advocate and an activist, early in my time as an academic, I was sort of trying to bridge the two worlds, and one of the things I did was I participated in a coalition that we called the Women's Committee of 100. So I was doing research, but I also was lobbying and trying to do some advocacy on this before the big welfare reform that happened in the middle 90s. You know, and then since then, I've been writing about it and trying to continue to participate where I can, especially in my home state.
Excellent. And the Women's Committee of 100, you spend a lot of time on in the book, and it really formed to try to do some lobbying. Why don't you just give us some background about all the sort of legislative fights and how the Women's Committee started and some of this reform? We're in, you know, this broadcast in Arkansas, so all of the Arkanese have heard about President Clinton ending welfare as we knew it, but it didn't quite work out that way. So why don't you give us a sense of the background here?
Yeah, well, people in Arkansas might know more about the deeper history or some parts of the deeper history that that I don't know as well. But where I come in is in the middle 90s. I think sometimes we forget that there were debates not just between Republicans and Democrats, but within the Democratic Party that are not that different from the debates we're having today. A lot of it was between the kind of politics that Bill Clinton was trying to fashion coming out of Arkansas and then making his way onto the national stage. And he was really, you know, he was doing that by saying he was a new kind of Democrat, a different kind of Democrat. That was very appealing to a lot of people. But he was particularly trying to draw a line about how he wasn't going to be beholden to or supposedly beholden to traditional Democratic interests or something like that. And unfortunately, that meant very publicly pissing off a lot of people who were advocates for women and people of color in particular and for labor, labor groups. And the welfare issue became, I don't know, it was like hitting not just two birds, but maybe three or four birds with one stone, because it was a way to sort of talk about race and gender and class or income and poverty all at once, and to seem, for Bill Clinton and for Democrats who were sort of going down his road, it was a way to seem like they were charting a new course, like they were doing something different, innovative, I don't know, I guess more white, more middle class oriented, et cetera. And the group that I was part of was trying to keep especially the gendered aspects of it, the impact on women of making big cuts in welfare programs, and the impact especially on low-income women and women of color, you know, to keep that in the conversation and the frame. And what we saw was that those mainstream Democrats under Bill Clinton were they were sort of fashioning a devil's bargain, that they were going to throw a group of people that they saw as a small, vulnerable group under the bus, and that they thought that they could then save the Democratic Party or save themselves, you know, if they were willing to kind of pay that price, you know, the price that they actually didn't have to pay, but other people were going to pay it. So that was where we wanted to step in. And it was really hard. It was hard to get other Democrats and progressives and even feminists, some self-declared feminists, to really see it in that way.
I think it's important for people to understand the title of your book, Insuring Poverty. It's not I-N-S-U-R-I-N-G. It's insuring poverty. It's insuring as in guaranteeing poverty. And that's part of what the argument in your book makes for what the personal responsibility Clinton welfare reform did, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think we're trying to point out this kind of paradox. We have this social program today. It's called Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF, and that's what was created out of the welfare reform of the middle 90s. And as we all, you know, go on about our business, we like to think that when those kinds of programs exist, they take care of people who are in desperate need and that they help people get out of poverty. And certainly that was the rhetoric when this program was created. But what we're saying is, on the other hand, we have to recognize that that program actually ensures, guarantees that people are going to be in poverty, and it doesn't offer any kind of an off-ramp. You know, it doesn't provide access to education, it doesn't provide child care, it doesn't, at least a guarantee of child care. And that's by design, like from the get-go, even though the rhetoric was all blah, 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 we're going to get people off the rolls and give them, you know, new avenues of respectability and dignity and so on, like it was never there. There was never a guarantee of any kind that people would have, you know, safe, affordable, decent child care for their kids, that they would have access to education and training. In fact, people lost access to education and training in this law that they had before this existed.
The only thing we want to call attention to that they really were able to accomplish is reducing the cost.
So, yes, and then like there's a kind of funny, this maybe I as a member of the academic community have to kind of underline this one and point even to some of my colleagues in universities for this, because what happened was that people focused on a certain kind of metric. Researchers focused on, you know, how many people are receiving welfare? What's the quote-unquote size of the caseload, right? What's the number of people on the rolls? And they saw that that number of on the rolls or the size of the caseload was going down. So everybody said, yay, it's a success. But it's a totally lopsided way to see it.
Yeah, exactly. And President Clinton and others tried to claim it was a success because the economy happened to be a little bit better. People were forced into very low-wage jobs. It helped create the entire home care industry, home daycare industry, which, you know, is still one of the fastest-growing jobs in the country, but
yes,
also the lowest-paid job about in terms of average wages in the country. So it really, and given that states are in charge of the benefits, it meant no progress at all for states like Arkansas, Louisiana, or Alabama, you know, that had miserly benefits at best, correct?
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. The national government has always had a somewhat hands-off approach and has allowed individual states to structure the program the way they want to, and sometimes that means that, you know, states that, I don't know, in the Midwest where they're trying to get people into certain kinds of agricultural employment, they use the welfare system, kind of manipulate it for that purpose. And states that have certain patterns of racial discrimination have used the welfare system to sort of support that system. And after the welfare reform of the middle 90s, this law that Bill Clinton signed after it was given to him by the Republican Congress, like, states have had even more control, and so there's even more diversity and disparity depending on whether you're in a more pro-welfare kind of liberal state or whether you're in a more anti-welfare or lower tax base kind of a state. and it's become really egregious in that way.
Well, we're talking to Felicia Kornbluh, a professor at the University of Vermont, who's written a book called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform and Feminist Perspective. But part of what this did was introduce a whole level of, you argue in the book, feminist perspective. This was anti-family, anti-women. It was racial. I mean, when you actually take the covers off and look at the act itself, I mean, part of what your book goes through fairly excruciatingly to read for somebody like me, this was heavily freighted ideologically, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I think we're arguing on two tracks at once. On the one hand, we really want to direct people to the specifics, right? This particular law, product of a very, very conservative Republican Congress and this mainstream Democrat in the White House who was very worried about his own political future, right? This particular law and the accommodations it made and the particular way that it exposed a group of low-income women, including a lot of women of color, to harm. But then we also, and so that obviously is a kind of a sexist thing, right? Welfare is not just stereotyped as a poor women's program, but by definition, that's what it is. It's for poor women and their kids. But we also want to say
the AFDC portion that was absolutely for largely for women and their kids.
Yeah, exactly. And some fathers, you know, if a father is a primary parent, you know, may be eligible. But that's the structure, that's the design. And then we also want to say, kind of in global terms, like, what are we saying about families overall? What are we saying about those people who do the caregiving work in families, whoever they may be, right? Like, I don't know anybody who is really delighted with their childcare situation and who really finds it affordable and, you know, exactly what they want and, you know, who finds that the child teacher ratios are exactly what they would want them to be, or anybody who thinks that like their healthcare is so fantastic and so affordable in America and that their kids, you know, that it's easy for their kids to get exactly what they need in the way of supportive healthcare. Like, you know, and what about our disabled or ill or elderly family members? You know, so many of us are doing that really dignified and important caregiving work as well. And what this law, the history of this law really reveals is how out of whack our whole politics is, I think, in terms of not dignifying that work, not paying attention to it, not making a place for it, kind of acting it with a willful denial like it's not happening, like that's not where so many of us are spending our time and having deep concerns and challenges and stresses. So I think we want to work on both strands.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal a week or so ago that about, you know, the fact that business was complaining that they were losing high-skilled, highly educated women employees who were leaving the workplace because they had no choice but to go and take caregiving responsibilities for elderly parents and family members. And it was like it was a surprise. Oh, my God. It's, you know, if it's happening here in the executive corridor on Wall Street, maybe that is important. But that doesn't mean there is any solution for it, is there, Professor Kornbluh?
No, I mean, the kinds of solutions that come from the elite private sector are, I think, you know, and we know this from history, that we had the same conversation in the 1980s, and a couple of large corporations had created on-site childcare centers, and they got nice write-ups in the business press and so on, but it really didn't make a dent in terms of most people's experiences of doing important kinds of family work. Yeah, you know, we really need a public solution.
Well, and, you know, your point about daycare and supportive caregivers, I mean, it's going to be hard to ignore, but if we look at the situation for the very poor that are covered under welfare, it seems like policymakers are very able to ignore this.
Well, they have been. I have to say the last couple of years...
This is such a non-issue right now. I mean, you and I are fired up about it, but yeah, this is not going to be one of the first 100 bills in the new Congress with the new majority, is it?
No, it's not. But let me give a little silver lining. I was going to...
Well, good. I was going to wait until the end to ask, please, Lysia, tell us some good news. Is there any? But go ahead. Let's get to it.
Well, first of all, I think it's a really important moment for us to be historicizing what happened in the 90s and really talking about how, particularly the Democratic Party, went wrong, in my view. This is like the, you know, the great sin of the modern Democratic Party. And there were some times during the 2016 Democratic primaries when we started to have this conversation, this very important conversation about what happened to the mainstream of the party and kind of unearthing some of the dissident voices that had been there in the 90s and then had sort of gotten covered up by a kind of pretend consensus among Democrats. You know, they had a kind of pretend consensus about what we call neoliberalism and a certain pattern of trade that disadvantaged a lot of people and being kind of anti-union and being especially anti-teacher and, I mean, all that stuff, which I find sort of abhorrent. So anyway, we started having the conversation in 2016, and thanks to Black Lives Matter and thanks to Bernie Sanders' candidacy and other stuff, it was a pretty serious conversation. And then I think everybody went back to their defense mode because Trump is so awful, and that was, I think, necessary. And now people are breathing a little bit more again, and those dissident voices are coming out again. And I think it's important for us to remember that when people stand up today and say, you know, I dissent from that kind of mainstream anti-worker, anti-poor people, anti-woman kind of politics, that first of all, they don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? That they're actually standing on the shoulders of other people who made similar arguments in the 90s. And then I just think there's a big opportunity, you know, and those of us who care about poverty and the programs that serve poor people, we have to get in that conversation. I think it's up to us to speak to people who call themselves feminists but who don't want to talk about poor women or women of color, people who call themselves progressives but don't want to talk about families because they just want to talk about the labor market or something, people who call themselves Democrats and they want to make some kind of a deal with the corporate sector so that they can be well-funded Democrats. Like, I think it's up to us to push on all of those areas,
no,
and maybe we can.
That.
Yeah.
Now, when I was in welfare rights in the late 60s and before I started ACORN, Gloria Steinem, Jane Fonda certainly showed up at major welfare rights protests. And they were feminist spokespeople at the time, and there were definitely relationships with all the major sort of established and fledgling feminist organizations then. But we're talking about almost 50 years ago. What happened between then and the 90s? When you talk about this sort of estrangement we had in some cases with feminist movements on fighting for low-income women at the point of the Clinton welfare reform, what happened there?
God, that is such
obviously
a great
it's a major
question.
Part of your book, so you know.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
You know, give us one quick answer, but no, I mean, this is something that you've mentioned that we need to sort of. Is there a way to unpack this a little bit?
Well, I guess big picture or headline news would be a lot of feminist organizations, mainstream feminist organizations, have just felt themselves vulnerable and under attack. And their strategy, I think, has just been a mirror of the Democratic Party strategy. And they have pursued a really kind of elite majority white, wealthy kind of donor base, and therefore political profile. And, you know, that's it's not everybody, it's not every group, it's not 100% of their agenda, but I think their strategy for survival has been about that. And it's a lot easier to survive if you can get, you know, a small number of humongous grants from very, very rich people than it is to try and get a million small grants from people who don't have a lot of money. And we have seen the same thing when people try and finance their political elections. So I think it's the same kind of dynamic. And, you know, it's constantly been under assault, and there's constantly been dissidents and dialogue about it. But it feels a lot of the times like yapping at the heels. maybe yapping at the high heels of these elite kind of
corporate. I don't want to go too far with this metaphor, but yeah, I hear you.
But there's a lot of action right now around that. You know, there's a lot of action around what we call reproductive justice as a critique of a mainstream reproductive rights movement, you know, and reproductive justice includes issues like welfare and poverty, because what we say, and I stand with this movement, I'm part of this movement, what we say is that having abortion rights and legal birth control is not enough, because we have to ensure that people who want to have children really are able to make that choice, in addition to people who don't want to have kids being able to make that choice, right? And if we look at both sides of that coin, it means that we have to take on a very expansive, very challenging agenda.
Absolutely. We're talking to Felicia Kornbluh, who's a professor at the University of Vermont, about her new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspectives. Felicia, when you talk in your book about reproductive justice, you also talk about reproductive injustice that is embedded in things like limits to, you know, benefit payments for the number of children, the priority towards fatherhood as opposed to recognition of motherhood. Why don't you expand on those arguments for us a little bit?
Yeah, I think some of it may be hard to for us to get our heads around, but even a thing in the law, in the welfare law, that says that we're going to give states a bonus for bringing down the numbers of teen parents, right? Even that can be invidious and can be problematic for families, and we see that as a form of reproductive injustice, because it's giving a financial benefit for not having children, and for state governments and local governments to do whatever they have to do to get people to not have children, and that's going to lead to coercion, right? It means that we're in the universe of not allowing people free choice. And certainly when we talk about massive benefit cuts, when we talk about putting an absolute maximum on the number of years that somebody could receive assistance for their family, when we talk about the so-called family cap, which the national law explicitly allows states to introduce, it says that if you have like one child when you start receiving public assistance and then you have an additional child, you don't get any additional money in your grant. So it means essentially that your existing kids get less. You know, every child you have gets less money.
Yeah, let's punish children, sure. And all the stuff about families and coherent families, I mean, in the overall U.S. culture wars, there are less marriages and there are more births across the spectrum without the benefit of marriage and single parents. Yet we're penalizing poor women who are single parent heads of families and their children. I mean, everywhere in the rest of the culture, from the middle class on up, it's going one way, but
right.
the ideological caps in the law, and look, you know, read you follow the discussions that are still, I mean, victimizing welfare as a principle, as if people are out there, you know, going wild having children, like everybody else, for almost no benefit. So what do you make of all that? That's crazy.
Well,
is that going to help us?
It is crazy. I think part of the reason that we explicitly wanted to call it a feminist perspective was because we wanted to suggest that if you put on that lens of a feminist analysis, some of these things make more sense than they do otherwise. Otherwise, it just seems kind of nuts. But right, we don't ask ourselves, like, what's actually harming people? Oh, poverty is harming people, right? Lack of access to medical care is harming people. Lack of access to childcare, education, employment, those things are harming people, right? Lack of decent food is harming people. And so we don't just ask that as a society, as a government, and then say, oh, how do we go about fixing that. Instead, we say, oh my God, people are raising children without benefit of legal marriage. Like, because we have some old idea, an old moralistic idea, an old sexist idea about what families are supposed to look like, what child rearing is supposed to look like. And then the social science, the policy science, and even the public programs are all created around that. And I see that as...
Even though society is moving in a different direction.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just normal. We would expect that low-income people would be kind of following the same trend as everybody else, right? That's kind of normal.
Well, absolutely, and people end up on welfare from all different perspectives. So you and your co-author, Gwendolyn Mink, who is the daughter of the renowned congresswoman from Hawaii, Patsy Mink, when are y'all going to organize another committee of 100? It sounds like if the time is right, something like this needs to be out there in the fray again. Is that already happening?
It's not really happening yet, and it's good for you to push me and push us to do that.
We'll say the call for the new Women's 100 came on this show. I'll send you the link, and you can pass it around. Okay, go ahead, Felicia. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, the organizing that's happened in the last 2 years, I hope you agree about this, has been unbelievably amazing, right? I mean, there are a lot of people in action, including a lot of people.
A huge amount of energy,
feminist.
Not so many organizations.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, except the ones that are
Somebody like me has to worry about, can we sustain it all? But, yeah, that's a whole other conversation for another time, too.
Yeah, so I'd like to see that. We were starting to pull a network together. Actually, we were going to come together at the time of the Women's March in D.C., and then my mother died, so I couldn't participate in that. But I think you're right. The time is now.
Well, and I know you and Gwendolyn Mink are out here pushing this book. It'd be interesting to hear what people say as you talk about these stories. Is there any other good news we have on the welfare front, Professor Kornblum?
Well, I think one piece of good news is that the Trump administration has not been able to do what it wants to do. Right? They wanted to use the welfare reform playbook of the 90s to create major changes in the SNAP program or the food stamp program, for example, and they just failed to do that. So I think that's a really good sign. I think
it's amazing how these work requirements, though, are just everywhere we look now. People are, in some of the states, the Republican-controlled states, are trying to add the old welfare work requirements into one program after another that is out there.
I know, yeah. And they haven't learned. They haven't learned that what that's going to do is it's going to kill people. I mean, really, work requirements in Medicaid, people just won't get health care.
In your book, obviously, you also looked at the, family assistance program and Daniel Monahan and, the times I was a little bit more familiar with when I was working for welfare rights. And, I often wonder, I mean, we obviously fought aggressively against the FAP program on a whole number of fronts, but did we do the right thing? Should we have taken a deal at some money as opposed to hoping we could do better later? Because we certainly didn't do better later. I often look and say, oh, my God, I mean, the situation for welfare recipients in many ways is so much worse now than it was when we thought it was terrible and when I first started organizing.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I think the only way that low-income moms and kids would have been better off, would have been better off today if something different had happened in the past, would have been if the program that they rely on had been lumped together with some other programs. So like today we have SSI, Supplemental Security Insurance, right, which is a combination of a whole bunch of old programs that used to serve blind people and elderly people who didn't have access to regular Social Security, right, and other disabled people. So they're at least all together. They can kind of huddle together for warmth, and they can be a more effective lobby standing up for their program. And that program is a better program because it's national, not state, So if moms had been included in that, that might have been better.
Well, that and it might have given them more political protection. You made an excellent point about the role of the Blind Federation in some of these programs. But darned if I didn't think I saw some note recently about the Trump administration arguing for some cutback in SSI benefits as well. Did I say the wrong thing? Or did you see that as well?
I think there are a lot of forces in politics today that would like to attack even that program for elderly and disabled people and under SSI. I'm hoping that we'll see that there's more of a pushback around that because there are a bunch of different groups and there are family members of those people who are willing to fight. And I guess I do wish that something had been different in the past that would have allowed low-income moms and kids to be included in that coalition.
Absolutely. Felicia, how do people get your book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspectives?
The book is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. You can get it through them or from any major bookseller. It's Ensuring with an E, Poverty, and my last name starts with a K, K-O-R-N-B-O-U-H. And you can always find me. I tweet, not constantly, but often, at VT Feminist, and I'm at the University of Vermont, and easy to find through the History Department there.
Thank you.
At VT Feminist and Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspective. Look for news of Professor Kornbluh and Gwendolyn Mink and others getting together more activity to reform welfare. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wage World. Thank you.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement to our sister stations WDSV 91.9 FM in Greenville, Mississippi, and KABF 88.3 FM in Little Rock, Arkansas. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.